Issues Etc. 24, Hour 5, starts now.
There's a fascination with the book of Daniel that in many ways, although it deals with certain sections of the book of Daniel, in many ways misses the point about the book of Daniel. The fascination comes with the apocalyptic sections where Daniel's visions and dreams and the visions and dreams of those around him are interpreted. Those are certainly important parts of the book of Daniel. There's no doubt about it. But there is a tendency to fixate on those and forget that the book of Daniel also tells a story and is set in an actual historical context. And maybe if we understood a little better the story, the message of the book of Daniel and its historical context, there wouldn't be so much misinterpretation of what Daniel has to say in his apocalyptic sections. We're going to be looking at the entire book of Daniel in the next 2 hours of Issues Etc. 24. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We invite your questions or comments. Dr. Andrew Steinman is our guest, 1-877-623-MYIE. We are coming to you live, 877-623-6943. Send us an email with your question or comments. talkback@issuesetc.org. We have left a place at the Issues Etc. Facebook fan page for you to leave your questions or comments on the Book of Daniel in the next 2 hours, facebook.com/issuesetc, or you can send us a tweet at @issuesetc. Dr. Andrew Steinman is professor of theology and Hebrew at Concordia University Chicago, and he's author of the Concordia Commentaries on Daniel, Ezra, and Nehemiah, and no, he is not author of the one on the Song of Songs. I don't think he is, although that's what it says. I still have enough presence of mind at this point to catch the odd mistake. He is author of the commentaries on Daniel and Ezra and Nehemiah. Dr. Steinman, welcome back to Issues Etc.
I'm glad to be back with you, Todd. The other book you're looking for is Proverbs.
Proverbs, that's what it is. Thank you very much. And I'll correct it. Dr. Steinman, one of the things that I don't think is often noted by people who are rather enthusiastic about the book of Daniel, especially its apocalyptic sections, those sections that deal with what many people believe are the end times, when in fact we'll correct that as time, as our conversation goes on, is the historical context. This is really the story of Daniel set at the lowest point for Israel in its history. This is as bad as it gets for these people. Why is it important for us to understand that so that we can understand what God is saying in the book of Daniel?
Well, when we understand that this is the time of the Babylonian captivity, Daniel's one of the first Judeans taken into the Babylonian captivity. You know, it comes in waves, and Daniel's in the first wave. We understand that, you know, God's people are going to see the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. They're going to see their visible connection with God with that temple cut off. They're going to be at a very low point and wondering, what is God up to? Is God still with us? And one of the things that's very clear as you read through the book of Daniel is that God is making the point that he is still in control of all of history, and that he's controlling history for the benefit of his people. And so Daniel makes it very clear that even though he's in captivity, his fellow Judeans are in captivity, God has not forgotten about them. He's still in charge. He's still looking over them, and he still has a plan for them that, of course, is going to culminate in the coming of the Messiah.
So who is this Daniel? He will be known through most of the book really as kind of a member of the king's court, whatever the king may be. But who is this Daniel, and to what strange land has he and his fellow Judeans been brought?
Daniel is apparently probably an upper-class Judean who's taken into captivity, along with several of his friends that are mentioned also in the book. He's, as the book begins, a very young man. But despite the fact that he's young, he has a strong faith, a faith that trusts implicitly in God, and he's one of the great examples of faith in the face of all kinds of opposition. Yet he maintains that faith, and in fact, God calls him to be a prophet and blesses his faith and gives him a great insight so that he can be a member of the Babylonian king's court, later the Persian king's court, serve them, and still have integrity in his faith without having to compromise it in any way. So he's quite a remarkable individual. At the end of the book, of course, he's very old, but he's very young at the beginning.
People often wonder why would he, or any Judeans for that matter, been even given a shot at a place in the king's court?
Yeah, well, I think this is part of the Babylonian strategy. You know, they have to dominate these lands they conquered. And in some ways, they need kind of the loyalty of the conquered peoples. And so by taking especially young men like Daniel, the plan is to kind of acculturate them into Babylonian culture, but yet have, you know, these people around to make good use of, and also perhaps to help pacify these people they've taken into captivity. If they see some of their own people in positions in the royal court, perhaps they'll feel a little bit better about being in captivity and won't be perhaps so rebellious. And so it's kind of a shrewd political thing that the king is doing here, and at the same time trying to tap into some of what he perceives as the best talent among these people.
The story begins with, and this is a very famous one, it seems a bit trivial that they distinguish themselves, Daniel and his other companions, in the king's court by eschewing what the king would have normally afforded them, which was kind of a place at his table. Why?
Well, apparently they are trying to maintain the laws of Moses. You know, the Babylonians don't necessarily keep kosher, as we might say. They don't keep the laws of Moses necessarily in what they eat. But Daniel wants to be loyal, and so we have the story of them refusing to eat the king's delicacies. And this has led to a lot of speculation among scholars as to exactly what they're up to. But I think it's pretty simple as what Daniel's up to. When he says, "Give me and my friends just vegetables to eat. Don't give us meat." I think Daniel shows his wisdom, his God-given wisdom, right away, because he could have given, you know, the person who was responsible for these young men, he could have given them a list of animals that they can't eat. These are not on our list, but we can't eat these animals, and would have been very complicated. But there are no non-kosher vegetables, so I think Daniel in his wisdom just says, give us vegetables to eat. Then he doesn't have to educate him on, oh, well, we can eat beef, but we can't eat pork or whatever, you know. They can just say, we'll just eat the vegetables. And in this way, they can be loyal to God. It's not a major affront to the king, but nevertheless, he can keep that faith and do the things in the law of Moses that God's Old Testament people were asked to do, and at the same time do it very diplomatically so that he can remain in the Babylonian court where God has placed him.
Then immediately we're thrust into kind of the, what shall we say, the role that he may have been being trained for, which is not just a wise man, but what would have been a soothsayer, something along these lines, someone who advises the king by divine means, I think. And it begins, I mean, he's given the opportunity. Nebuchadnezzar has a dream. What happens there?
Yeah, well, Nebuchadnezzar has this dream, and oddly enough, he demands that the men in his court, whom he employs for, like you say, to give him kind of counsel from the gods. Remember, they're pagans, so they believe in many gods. These men he employs, he demands that they tell him not only what the dream means, but before they do that, tell him the dream. He doesn't trust them, apparently, to tell him just what the dream means. If he tells them the dream, I guess he's afraid at this point that they'll tell him what he wants to hear. He must have some sense that this is no ordinary dream to make this demand. I think perhaps he senses, maybe, you know, he couldn't put it in our terms, that God specifically gave him this dream, but he senses that there's something special about this dream. Well, you can imagine these poor Babylonian wise men. He calls them in and says, okay, tell me what I dreamt last night, and then tell me what it means. Well, you know, if I were sitting at the kitchen table, my wife says, honey, tell me what I dreamt last night, I'd look at her like she was daft, you know, like, how can I tell you what you dreamt? But this is, of course, what he asks, and they say, no wise men can do this. And so the king gets angry and says, basically, off with their heads if they can't tell me. And Daniel, of course, is in danger. Daniel and his friends are in danger then of being executed too, because they're in training to be one of these guys. And so it's Daniel who, with his three friends, sits down and prays to God and asks him to reveal to him what the king asks. And God does just that, so that Daniel can tell the king both his dream and then what the dream means, and the king is satisfied then that he's been told the truth and not just some, you know, interpretation that'll make him feel good.
This is a means by which Daniel is gains favor with the king. What would that have meant for him and his companions?
Well, it would have meant an elevation in status, and in fact, the book tells us that they're given important jobs. But it might also have meant that in some ways it made his life a little bit more difficult. The book doesn't mention this, but you can imagine in the king's court when somebody's favored, somebody else gets jealous. And in fact, we have a story later on in the book of Daniel under another king where that exactly is exactly what happens. But it would have meant also for his people that perhaps he and his three friends who are given responsible positions now are in a position to maybe ease somewhat their misery as they're in the Babylonian captivity. And so, in a way, although the book doesn't mention what Daniel might have done for his people, but in a way, we're given a hint here that, yeah, God hasn't forgotten his people. He not only blesses Daniel, but by implication, I think we're told, he's blessing all of his people, even though they're in this foreign land, forcibly taken away from their homeland. God, you know, is still watching over them, and he's using people like Daniel that he's now placed in high positions, even though Nebuchadnezzar wouldn't realize that that's what God is up to. I'm sure Daniel and his friends did realize that was God had been up to.
It's kind of strange. It's almost as though the dream is given and the interpretation is told, but it all kind of goes over Nebuchadnezzar's head because the interpretation doesn't seem to have a lot to do with Nebuchadnezzar or his time, his reign. It seems to be all about, at least if we rightly understand it, it seems to be about God's kingdom and a much bigger swath of history than Nebuchadnezzar will ever have a part in.
Yeah, this dream of a statue with four medals, and it takes a sweep all the way from Nebuchadnezzar's day down the centuries to really the coming of Christ. And you're right, Nebuchadnezzar probably doesn't get everything in it, but Daniel and his interpretation of it does at least, you know, allow Nebuchadnezzar to have some part in it, because of course the first medal, this dream of this statue he sees with four medals. The first medal is the head, and it's made out of gold. And he specifically tells Nebuchadnezzar, you, O king, are the head of gold. And, of course, that's not only the correct interpretation of the dream, but it's also kind of politically correct, too, to make the king feel good. He's the most precious metal mentioned in the dream. He's the head of the statue. So God, you know, kind of provides Daniel with an interpretation that at least will give Nebuchadnezzar something here, even though the rest of the interpretation of the dream goes, as you say, well beyond Nebuchadnezzar's years.
I've often wondered, here is the story of this great statue, this brilliant statue of gold, and then, of course, as you go down the body, it becomes of less and less value. And then the very next thing that Nebuchadnezzar does is apparently have set up an enormous image. I don't know if it's a statue, it's just called an image, and then he demands that everyone worship it. Could it be that Nebuchadnezzar actually gets this dream almost entirely wrong?
I think it's very possible. I think what we see in the book of Daniel is Nebuchadnezzar comes to the point where he will acknowledge that Daniel's God is great, but he always remains a pagan, and so it shouldn't surprise us that he kind of gets the dream wrong. And perhaps you're right. Perhaps part of the connection here with the next statue, the one that Nebuchadnezzar sets up, or image, or whatever it is that he sets up, is that he hears this head of gold and he takes that and allows it to, in essence, go to his head, so that he makes this big statue, which he demands that all of the governors of the various provinces bow down and worship.
We've talked about this incident before, and of course, it is very familiar to our listeners, the whole story of the fiery furnace. What is most important in the way that this is told, and ultimately in the message that is delivered not only to Nebuchadnezzar and to Daniel, but to us?
Well, the most important thing is to see how God is with these three men. We know them best as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, the Babylonian names that Nebuchadnezzar gave them. It's to see how God gave them this great faith, faith that was willing to stand up even to the threat of death of Nebuchadnezzar, and then, of course, how God is with them even in the fiery furnace. And you know, we even get a hint that Nebuchadnezzar understands that there's something special going on here, because, of course, when he sees four men in the furnace, he jumps up and says, and the fourth one looks like a son of the gods. And Nebuchadnezzar, of course, is probably saying more than he realizes. He understands that this fourth person that he sees in the furnace is special in some way, and probably his words reveal more than what he thinks, because I think very clearly the irony is here that this is God in the furnace with these men, and in fact, I believe it's the second person of the Trinity, Jesus, before his incarnation, that's there with these three young men protecting them. So it's a story from beginning to end of God's work in the lives of these three young men, that he gives them faith, faith that's willing even to defy the king when he demands that they abandon their faith and worship this idol, and then he's there with them in the fiery furnace. And so it's a great message to God's people that God is the one who gives your faith, sustains your faith, and when you have to put that faith on the line, that God is there with you, even in, you know, face of death, God doesn't abandon you. And, of course, Christian martyrs over the years, starting with the very earliest Christian martyrs to the martyrs that still die for the faith today, God is with them in the same way, and he's the one that gives and sustains that faith and sees them through even to death.
Can you explain, you mentioned before that Nebuchadnezzar will acknowledge that the God of Daniel and his companions is a great God, but he remains pagan through and through. In that context, explain his edict or his letter that is recorded at the end of chapter 3, at the beginning of chapter 4 of Daniel's book.
Yeah, he has this edict that everybody is supposed to respect the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, the God that rescued them from the fiery furnace, that no God can rescue like this, which should have been a clue, I guess, to Nebuchadnezzar himself, that this is just no ordinary pagan God, but he just never quite gets it. But it's an edict that basically says that they and their fellow Judeans are free to worship this God, and that anybody who would, you know, kind of persecute them is going against the king's will. And in a way, again, it shows God watching over his people in the captivity, because I'm sure the Jews were seen as this kind of peculiar people, these Judeans who will only worship one God. I mean, this is totally unheard of in the rest of the ancient world, that, you know, people will only worship one God, will not acknowledge any other gods. There were plenty of pagans who worshiped primarily one God, but they didn't have any trouble acknowledging all these other gods out there. But these Judeans were just so strange to the rest of the world because they wouldn't even acknowledge any other gods. Well, this gives them a certain amount of breathing room in Babylon to do that. And so those who were faithful, like Daniel and Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego, now were given a little bit of a breathing room and even a kind of official support for doing this, even though Nebuchadnezzar himself probably never understands the idea of a monotheism, that there is only one true God, and that is the only God that is to be worshipped.
A real quick question from Stephen. He asks about what appears to be a missing section in Daniel. Usually it would be Daniel 3, verses 52 through 90. I think it's actually a Greek insertion. He asks, why did this get dropped from the quote-unquote Protestant canon? What about the, and it's not the only one that's found in some very ancient manuscripts of Daniel.
Yeah, there are a couple expansions of Daniel chapter 3. There's a prayer of one of these young men, Azariah, who's also got a Babylonian name. He's Meshach. And then there's the prayer of these three young men. These prayers actually weren't originally part of Daniel when it was composed. They were added later on and are found in the Greek version of Daniel. It's very clear when you read these in Greek that they are a later composition, that they're not part of the original composition. So they weren't really dropped from Daniel. They were never there in the original Hebrew Aramaic. Daniel's in two languages originally, Hebrew and Aramaic. They weren't there in the Aramaic section of chapter 3 to begin with. But they are added later on as somebody contemplates what these young men must have been praying while they were in the fiery furnace. And they're wonderful prayers. They're magnificent prayers. And especially this prayer of the three young men has traditionally been included in Lutheran hymnals and has actually been used among Lutherans for worship for centuries, even though we don't acknowledge it as part of Scripture because it was a later addition. But this these additions from the Greek talk about these three young men praising God and calling really on all of creation to bring praise to God. And so whoever writes these imagines these three young men strong in the faith, even though they're in the midst of the fiery furnace.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation during Issues Etc. 24 on this Friday night, April the 8th, with Dr. Andrew Steinman on the Book of Daniel. Interesting, right there in chapter 4, as Nebuchadnezzar ends his short letter or decree, the voice of the author changes. It changes from an anonymous narrator, maybe Daniel himself, to Nebuchadnezzar himself. Maybe we're pulling from actual ancient court documents because Nebuchadnezzar takes up the story in chapter 4. We'll talk about that on the other side of the break. Our call-in number this Friday night, April the 8th, as we talk about the Book of Daniel during Issues Etc. 24, 1-877-623-MYIE, or visit our Facebook fan page and leave questions for Dr. Steinman on Daniel right there, facebook.com/issuesetc.
Others talk. We have something to say. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Hi, I'm Teresa, and I'm from Maple Grove, Minnesota. And my story about Issues Etc. would have to be all those aha moments that I've had. Sometimes a guest or someone will make a point, and it just really strikes me. It really hits a chord with me. And there have been many of them, some during Will Wheaton's hymn reviews or many others during some of the wonderful guests that you have. And it seems those moments always happen at the strangest time, like when I'm mowing my lawn or baking Christmas cookies or driving down the highway. But one of the most memorable aha moments that came for me came during last year's Issues Etc. 24. Dr. Andrew Steinman was doing his segment on Proverbs. I knew he'd eventually get around to talking about the wife of noble character that is described in Proverbs 31. I knew about this because my pastor would sometimes read this section after the church service on Mother's Day. And I would sit in the pew and listen to him extol the virtues of this amazing woman. She's like this. She's like that. She does this, and she would do that. And I would sit and think about myself and go, that's not me either. I would even joke and laugh with my family and friends afterwards about how I'm not anywhere close or even in the ballpark compared to this lady. I mean, she sets the standard pretty high. But secretly, I just ended up feeling inadequate and like I didn't measure up. But Dr. Steinman explained that because of Jesus, God does see me as being lovely and wonderful in his eyes, and that I'm just as admirable and worthy as she is. Through Jesus and because of him, I am now that woman of noble character, at least I am to him. And that was my aha moment for me. What had been a heavy burden had been lifted off, and I felt such relief. Whenever law turns to gospel, those are always aha moments. And, well, that one was one of mine. So that's my story. And thank you to Issues Etc. for providing all those wonderful aha moments when God's good news and mercy is clearly proclaimed. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Well, thank you. This is Jeff Schwarz, producer of Issues Etc., alongside with Craig Feichninger, business money guy here at Lutheran Public Radio. And, you know, Craig, one of the things that gives me one of the strengths of the show is what that comment was just talking about. It's the guests. The show's not about Pastor Wilkin, Jeff Schwarz, or Craig Feichninger. It's a team approach.
Wait a minute. I thought it was all about me, Jeff.
Yeah, that's why the only time we give you your mic is during Issues Etc. 24. Now you know why. But anyway, it's a team effort here at Issues Etc. She mentioned hearing Dr. Steinman, frequent guest on the show, and great guy, and talking about it, listening to him last year during Issues Etc. 24 about the Proverbs 31 woman. As long as we continue to have guests who continue to espouse this Christ-centered, cross-focused message here at Issues Etc., the show will go on. It's not a cult of personality like so many, parachurch radio outreaches, internet outreaches with one guy behind a mic. And once that guy goes by the wayside, the whole parachurch organization suffers. No, this is about a team approach. And we thank God for listeners, and we thank God for a great stable of guests here on Issues Etc.
Hey, Jeff, you know, I've often heard you and Todd both say smartest listeners in radio. I think we need to add to that also smartest guests in radio. So you're right. That's a true, true blessing to us here at Issues Etc.
So if you appreciate the guests that we have here on Issues Etc., please consider making a donation to support this worldwide, and I do mean worldwide, outreach. You can donate, if you're listening live, toll-free, 877-623-6943, 877-623-6943. If you're listening at your convenience, on demand, you can call during regular office hours, 618-223-8385, 618-223-8385. And in about an hour and 20 minutes or so, we'll be drawing for the Lutheran Study Bible for anybody who donates $100 or more to Issues Etc. Your name goes in for a drawing here throughout Issues Etc. 24. And in about 90 minutes, we'll be drawing God's Word for today on the book of Daniel, which Todd's discussing right now with Dr. Steinman. So pledge, donate online, issuesetc.org. Go to the donate page, issuesetc.org, or call 618-223-8385 or 877-623-6943. Thanks for supporting Issues Etc. during Issues Etc. 24.
Now when the three were cast in and the king rose up to witness their awful fate, he began to tremble at what he saw, and in astonished tones he spake. Did we not cast three men bound into the midst of the fire? I believe I see four men unhurt, unbound and walking down there. I see.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I could listen to Johnny Cash all night. Great evening music here on Issues Etc. 24, talking about the book of Daniel. Dr. Andrew Steinman is our guest, professor of theology and Hebrew at Concordia University, Chicago. and author of the Concordia Commentaries on Daniel, Ezra and Nehemiah, and the Book of Proverbs. Dr. Steinman, it's an odd shift, and I wonder why it's there. I'm sure you have an explanation for why, and I guess the first question is chapter 4 all one letter from Nebuchadnezzar, or does the letter end at verse 3 and then some other document from the courts of Nebuchadnezzar is appended here, letting Nebuchadnezzar tell his own story in the first person? Just switches from third person to first person that abruptly.
Yeah, well, most of the letter, most of the chapter is the letter from Nebuchadnezzar. He actually speaks, you know, kind of in the first person all the way down through verse 24. At least that's the way it is in the Aramaic. He tells the story down through verse 24, and then from 25 through 30, the story's in the third person. It's not Nebuchadnezzar saying "I." It's all this came on King Nebuchadnezzar, and all of a sudden he's not telling the story anymore. But then in verse 31, it comes back to Nebuchadnezzar's letter. At the end of the time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, it starts in verse 31. So what we have here is a letter from Nebuchadnezzar, but in the middle of verses 25 through 30, we have an insertion, which I believe was put in by Daniel himself. Daniel reproduces the letter of King Nebuchadnezzar, but when it gets to the sensitive part of what actually happened to Nebuchadnezzar, you know, kings in the ancient world didn't tell about their weaknesses. They told about their greatness and so forth. Well, this is a period of weakness and perhaps something that Nebuchadnezzar really doesn't want to make public in this apparently public letter that he sent out. And so Daniel stops and kind of inserts in the middle of the letter to tell us exactly what happened to Nebuchadnezzar before he allows the letter to go on again, where at the end Nebuchadnezzar praises God for God's power and for revealing to him some lesson that Nebuchadnezzar ends up learning through this incident.
This is weird. I mean, first of all, someone might suppose it weird that God would be sending dream messages to a thoroughly pagan king. And what actually ends up happening to Nebuchadnezzar is just strange. He goes from literally the height of his power, prowess, and pride to being reduced to one of the beasts of the field, and then back by divine decree restored again. What's going on?
Well, it's God's way of making his point with Nebuchadnezzar about who is really in charge. God has been making this point off and on in the first three chapters. And in this last chapter in which Nebuchadnezzar is going to appear, he finally makes the point directly to Nebuchadnezzar so he can't miss it. Nebuchadnezzar, of course, is the king who brings this new Babylonian empire to its peak. It makes it the greatest nation, the greatest empire in the world during his day. You can see where Nebuchadnezzar would get a pretty big head and think he did it all. And God wants to make the point to Nebuchadnezzar, no, I'm the one who sets kings up, and I'm the one who knocks them down. And you, Nebuchadnezzar, need to acknowledge that. And he makes this absolute point. And although Nebuchadnezzar never comes to acknowledge God as the only God, he will, at the end of this chapter, acknowledge the God that Daniel worships, the God that has been in charge all along, as the God who really is in charge. So this whole kind of strange incident where Nebuchadnezzar goes mad and acts like an animal for a period of time is a way of God humbling him to see that, no, he isn't as great as he thinks. His head is swollen a little bit too big. He's gained a couple hat sizes, and God's going to reduce that back again. To make sure he understands that he, like every other person, is subject to the divine king of the universe who uses his power and gives it to whomever he wants. And this is the lesson that Nebuchadnezzar learns, and Daniel includes this in the book as kind of the climactic story about Nebuchadnezzar, I think, to make the point to us, his readers, that we understand that God is in charge. So when, you know, we see all these crazy things going on in the world, perhaps for Christians in parts of the world where it seems as if things are out of control, they can be reassured they're not out of control at all, that even the vilest tyrant in the world is subject to God's plan, and that therefore they can be assured that Jesus is in control, that the one who died for their sins is also ruling over all things for their benefit.
The most that Nebuchadnezzar ever really learns from this is there is a God who's greater than me, perhaps even greater than the gods I call upon. Don't mess with him. I mean, it's nothing more than God's raw sovereignty, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, I mean, he gets the law part of it. I mean, that's definitely God's law, right? That's God's decree, God's in charge. He never gets the gospel side of the message, which is, in some ways, at least to my mind, one of the great tragedies about Nebuchadnezzar, that he is so wrapped up in paganism, so much a part of the pagan system of Babylon and the ancient Near East, that the gospel just never penetrates his heart. He always can't seem to grasp it and rejects what the Holy Spirit has put in front of him time and time again. So I guess it shouldn't surprise us that we meet people like that today, too, that are so wrapped up in the ways of the world that even though they hear the gospel, it's presented to them, they harden their heart and they don't let it penetrate. It's a real tragedy. It's something I'm sure that many, many Christians have seen at work in the world today. And, you know, we pray for such people. We hope that the gospel would penetrate their hearts, but we know that there are some whom the gospel never does, that they reject what the Holy Spirit has given them. And what a great tragedy that is. And you know, when we leave Nebuchadnezzar after chapter 4, we're almost left with kind of feeling of what a great miss opportunity that God had worked with this man and given him every opportunity, and he just never allows anything other than his pagan beliefs to dominate his worldview.
There's a shift at chapter 5. There's no transition is provided, although a little bit later you kind of discover where you're at in the dynasty here. But suddenly it's not King Nebuchadnezzar, it's King Belshazzar. Who is this?
Well, he is actually the son of the last great king of the Babylonian Empire, a man named Nabonidus. Nabonidus comes several kings after Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar had several successors on the throne. Eventually, Nabonidus is a Babylonian usurper and takes over the kingdom. He's not very popular in his own court. Eventually, he goes kind of into semi-retirement and puts his son Belshazzar on the throne as kind of almost a co-king. This is the time, of course, when Babylon is going into eclipse. The Persians to their northeast are rising in power, and what we find is that as we open up to chapter 5, that the Persians have Babylon surrounded. Belshazzar is in charge in Babylon, and foolishly he decides, well, we're behind Babylon's great walls, we'll just party, they won't get us in here. And that's kind of the setting of the book.
This is the famous hand writing on the wall, and it comes in the context, as you just mentioned, of this kind of one big final party. You know, the world's ending tomorrow.
Yes.
So let's just have the biggest blowout. So I don't know if it's exaggeration, but it's 1,000 of his lords, and they're drinking wine in front of the 1,000, and he's having this amazing party. And then they bring out the gold vessels, and I wonder how important this is, that it had been taken from the temple in Jerusalem, and they're using it for their pagan festivities. Is this, in a sense, a final straw of blasphemy for at least this Babylonian king?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, it's amazing when you read this, because, even pagans would have had a certain amount of reverence for anything that had been used in a temple. They may not acknowledge the true God. They may acknowledge that there are many gods, but they would have reverence for, you know, kind of holy vessels of any god from any temple. So this shows you that the wine was flowing pretty good. The judgment is impaired pretty well. And so they bring in these golden vessels, and they decide to drink toasts to their pagan gods out of them. And, of course, these are the vessels from the temple that had been dedicated to the worship of the true God in the temple in Jerusalem. And God is not pleased by this poor judgment. Like I said, even a pagan normally wouldn't have done anything like this. But then to do it against the God of Jerusalem and really to put your finger right in God's eye, you know, I've dominated your people. They're still captive here in Babylon, and even though we're kind of captive by the Persians, we can kind of thumb our nose at you and drink out of your vessels. Well, this is just, you know, kind of the height of bad judgment, even for the most pagan of pagans.
It's almost as though the narrator wants us to understand what's going on here. I mean, he leaves nothing to our speculation, where he says in verse 4, they drank wine and praised the gods of gold, silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Almost down the line of that previous vision that his grandfather had had, but they praised these pagan gods that were nothing more than the materials that they were made from.
Yeah, and this, of course, is the author's way, probably Daniel writing this. It's his way of saying to us, you know, that these gods really don't exist and that these guys, once again, don't get it. They didn't learn anything from what happened a few generations back to Nebuchadnezzar. They completely forgot all the lessons. And, in fact, Daniel's going to say as much when he appears in this chapter. And they just don't get the ridiculousness of making an image and then worshiping that image. This is a type of parody of pagan religion that we find in the other prophets. Isaiah has a notable passage about this, about how somebody cuts down a tree and part of it they burn in their fireplace for warmth and part of it they carve into a god and bow down and worship it. And how ridiculous is that, you know? Well, it's taking off on that same type of thing here when the author notes that they praise these gods of these made out of these different substances.
So immediately the fingers of a human hand appear, and they write something on the wall, and remarkably, no one can read it. Not even the wisest of Belshazzar's satraps can read this, but they know of one who they think can, and that is Daniel. Why can't they read it?
Well, that's been a long debate, but I think it's fairly simple. This is written on the wall, most likely in Aramaic, because when Daniel reads it, he reads it as Aramaic words. And they probably just ran all the words together. Now, keep in mind, Aramaic, like ancient Hebrew, they only wrote the consonants. You had to supply the vowels when you read it. And in very short messages, oftentimes they did just run the words together. Well, part of the problem was they could probably read it and make sense out of it in different ways, dividing the letters into words different ways, but nobody could make a convincing reading that said this is what it must mean. It's kind of, I call it kind of a parlor game for Aramaic scholars to sit down with these nine letters and divide them into words and see how many different ways you can read them, and I can think of at least five or six ways that you could possibly read it. But the question was, how can you read it in such a way as to convince everybody else that that's what the message was being sent to you by this hand that wrote on the wall?
What would a pagan have believed seeing this? A hand suddenly appears, disembodied hand, writing on the king's palace wall there, right for the king to see. He's right there across from the king where the king sits by his lampstand. And how would the pagan have understood this? What kind of event is this?
Well, they would definitely have understood it as some type of oracle from some god. I mean, again, they wouldn't necessarily understand it as coming from the true God. But the pagans were always, and this is why Nebuchadnezzar previously added all these people in his employ, is they understood that the gods sometimes gave signs to human beings, which had to be interpreted. What they would have been shocked at was actually seeing it. Usually they figured that such signs or oracles came just to special people, and you had to go to special places. And the fact that it would appear at the on a banquet wall as they were just all these, you know, kind of non-priestly types were there in the banquet would have struck them as something very, very not only important, but very, very much to be feared. They would have understood that this was probably not a favorable sign when they saw this. Because they weren't used to seeing these type of things. They would, again, go to somebody they thought is special, a special priest or a special astrologer or something who alone would have access to these signs and understand them. And the fact that all these just courtiers saw it, this no wonder the king's knees are knocking together and he's, you know, white as a sheet.
Daniel comes in before he reads it and explains it. He kind of compares Belshazzar with Nebuchadnezzar a little bit. Why that?
Well, because both of them have been arrogant, and they've been arrogant against Daniel's God, what he normally calls when he's in the presence of these pagan kings, the God of heaven. And he says, you've been arrogant against the God of heaven, and you knew all of this that happened to Nebuchadnezzar. And he goes through that stuff that we just read in chapter 4. You knew all this. You knew this happened, and you didn't humble yourself. You were just as arrogant when you drank out of these vessels. And so the reason he brings this up is to make the point that you had your chance. In the historic knowledge you had of what went on in the past, and you chose to kind of, insult God directly. And so now God has sent this message to you.
The message is, Mene Mene Tekel Upharsin, that's the Aramaic, and he reads it as, your days are numbered, you have been weighed and found wanting, and your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. And as soon as they've got the purple robe on Daniel, that very night, it happens. What period of history are we looking at here? What is the changing of the guard here that we can actually examine in terms of secular history? About a minute before we take our break.
Yeah, this is the night that Babylon falls to the Persian troops. They've been besieging the city. They have already defeated Nabonidus in battle. Belshazzar is here in Babylon, and it's the night that it falls, and the Babylonian Empire is done, and a new world empire is established, and that is the Empire of the Persians under Cyrus the Great.
When we come back, we'll meet Darius, and it appears that Daniel simply goes from one king to another, from one empire to another, but comes under Darius's rule. One of the most famous stories told about this prophet Daniel, and that is his night spent among the lions in the lion den. He passes the night completely unscathed because, as Daniel will later say, the angel of the Lord closed their mouths. Dr. Andrew Steinman is our guest. We're studying the book of Daniel. It's Issues Etc. 24, Friday night, April the 8th. Coming to you live, your questions and your comments on Daniel for Dr. Steinman are welcome during this break. 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MYIE. Send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org, or a tweet at issuesetc. As usual, we have left room for you to leave your questions or comments on the Book of Daniel at our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc.
No format change necessary. Jesus, the same yesterday, today, and forever. You're listening to Issues Etc.
My name is Dana from Indiana, and I listen to Issues Etc. because I am a recovering evangelical and have been Lutheran for 2 years. Issues Etc. helps me to discern truth, since the world, my flesh, and the devil are always trying to pull me away from Christ. Also, where else could I hear such great bump music? Thanks for the show.
Yeah, that's Talk Radio for Recovering Evangelicals, and here's a way you can support Talk Radio for Recovering Evangelicals. It's the Issues Etc. Reformation Club, our monthly or annual giving program.
Your gifts to the Issues Etc. Reformation Club allow us to budget our finances more efficiently, and also for you, there's some goodies associated with the Reformation Club, t-shirts, books, also your church's contact information on our website, and transcripts. And there are four different levels: the confessor, the apologist, the reformer, and the patron. You can call us at 877-623-6943 or 618-223-8385. And that number's for you on demand, folks, as well. To learn more about the Issues Etc. Reformation Club.
I've already had several new people, listeners, join the Issues Etc. Reformation Club, and thank you for that. But remember, during Issues Etc. 24, no gift is too small. We really want to hear from each and every one of you, and anything you can do to help support this worldwide outreach is deeply appreciated. You can make a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. Go to the donate page, issuesetc.org. Or if you're listening to us live, you can call 877-623-6943, 877-623-6943. Or if you're listening to us on demand, call us weekdays during regular business hours at 618-223-8385.
Any size gift is deeply appreciated, and we want to hear from you. We are about an hour away from drawing for two different books. That's a Bible study, God's Word for Today, on Daniel, and also the Lutheran Study Bible. And you'll be in the Lutheran Study Bible donation, or the drawing, if your donation is $100 or more. So that's a great value for that book, and we'll keep your name in when you give your donation all the way to the end of Issues Etc. 24. So you've got lots of chances to win some extra goodies during Issues Etc. 24.
Craig and I would gladly, man, it's already early.
Edit. There's better to write
words.
That one down.
Yeah. Not much editing going. Issues Etc. 24 is too much content to work from. But anyway, Craig and I would gladly take your pledge right now. 877-623-6943, 877-623-6943, or call, if you're listening on demand, 618-223-8385, 618-223-8385.